evening and welcome to another lecture organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum, which for the few of you I would imagine who haven't been yet has just been shown on the slides. Tonight we are pleased to once again welcome Professor John Variano, now on his fourth trip to Malta and not yet showing any signs of flagging. Many of you will recall his wonderful lecture last year, delivered to a packed house. We are particularly grateful to Professor Variano, not only for offering us these lectures, but for also very willingly agreeing to deliver a lecture on Caravaggio, which is one of his research specializations, to the Friends of the Museum on the 1st March. The lecture, which will be entitled Caravaggio and Violence, will not be open to the public, so your only possibility of attending is by signing up to become a friend of the museum before the 1st March. Now, Professor John Variano is Professor Emeritus of Art History at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts and the author of numerous studies on Italian art and gastronomy. His latest books are Taste and Temptations, Food and Art in Renaissance Italy, and Wine, A Cultural History. At present, he is conducting research on the 19th century and specifically on the famous author and painter Edward Lear during his stays in Malta. I hope we can convince him to tell us more about Lear in a future lecture. But today's talk takes us back in time to the Renaissance and is rather titillatingly titled Tastes and Temptations in the Italian Renaissance, Edible Art and Erudition. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Francesca. Since I arrived in Malta on February 7th, it seems like hardly a day has passed when I haven't thanked Francesca for some kindness, some courtesy. She's been my guardian angel here, grooming various paths that were very unfamiliar to me and been extremely helpful. I just wanted to say that in public. Now, this may seem like deja vu because I think it was in the same room about 4 months ago that my colleague Tim Schroeder gave a talk on the golden chips on tables, another form of table decoration, and I don't think anyone could ever fault the Palazzo Falzon for not paying enough attention to the decorative arts and table settings, because this, I'm afraid, is going to be another talk about table settings. And I'm fairly sure that when Dr. Schroeder is here, he probably showed this, which is believed to be the earliest example of a banqueting scene. It's Burgundian. It's from the early part of the 15th century. And it shows a wealth of eating implements, including a ship and some gold plates and so on. I'm going to jump from that into Italian art in particular and talk about some of the things which happened in dining, and not just what was eaten, but how it was eaten and how it was served. That's essentially my purpose. Perhaps many of you are familiar with this great pageant of a painting that Paolo Veronese made in the later part of the 16th century. He seemed to specialize in these very large banqueting scenes. He would give it a religious connotation, in this case, the figure of Christ, if you can find him, in the center of the canvas back here. And there's just a tremendous wealth of figures and diners and all manner of accessories to a banquet. There are people playing music. There's a woman in the right here who is picking her teeth with a silver toothpick. That level of detail is detail that actually got this painter into trouble, not with this painting so much as with another painting, which he passed off. The commission called for Last Supper. He painted a Last Supper, but it had so many secular details. It had so much interest and so absorbed in the material culture of his time and of Venetians who perhaps dined this way, that the Inquisition came after him and it asked him to repaint the picture. Instead of repainting the picture, he simply changed the title so it became Feast in the House of Levi instead of the Last Supper. That's one of the old chestnuts in Renaissance art. Now, in terms of table settings, probably the most familiar work I'm going to show this evening is this great salt cellar. It was made by Benvenuto Cellini for King Francis I of France when he, Cellini, was in residence in Fontainebleau. This object is made of solid gold. It's quite considerable in size. It's something like 10 or 12 inches by 15 inches. It's a work which was celebrated in another fashion just a couple of years ago when it was stolen from the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. It was eventually recovered. The greatest fear was that it would be melted down because it is solid silver. Currently, it's in a secure setting in Vienna and is insured for $68 million. Now, not many people could afford to commission a work like this. And for the enthusiasm of Francis I, Cellini actually quotes himself in his autobiographical, this is not a man who's lacking in hubris. He sort of gives himself a lot of credit for a lot of different things. He says here, when I first showed this to His Majesty, he uttered a loud cry of astonishment and could not satiate his eyes with gazing at it. He obviously liked it. Cellini doesn't give the cost of this object, but he gives what rewards he received for other objects that he made for Francis I. He made a set of candlesticks, 12 candlesticks, with figural decoration, for which he was paid 300 pounds of silver and given 500 gold crowns, gold coins. So this is expensive business, and not many people could afford it. Most of the designs we have for this kind of luxury item remained on paper, and the artist who did the most work in this area, somewhat unprofitably though, I think, is Giulio Romano, the most notable student of Raphael. And there are numerous drawings by Romano that show salt cellars. Salt is such a precious commodity in trade and in taxation of this period. And it's called white gold. And the salt is something that seems to play an important role in most banqueting tables. As a side note to this, what you see also in these three drawings is the interest of this period in natural history, what that we'd call natural science, the classification of all of nature, and a sometimes fine line between natural description and fable and fantasy, and these marine creatures that Romano depicts here are partly fantasy, of course. Now, a few of these precious objects were made. Here's an example from the 17th century attributed to some follower, Bernini, not terribly well known. But we should be aware that all that glitters is not gold. Or if you look very closely, if you can look closely enough at this image, I tried to make as large as I could, you realize that there's another palette there. There is the patination of bronze, which is beneath the gilding. This is a gilt bronze. This is the way to make something look dazzling, but in fact not cost what the precious metal would cost. And this is a period that in numerous ways had a great interest in matters of deception. This is the point in time when architects began using more and more marmo finto or faux marb. More and more stucco is being used in the 17th century in place of cut stone. And I suspect that costume jewelry probably came into, it's said to come into, we have the expert sitting right here, but costume jewelry is said to have begun in the 17th century to replace the real thing. What you're looking at here is really a bronze sculpture, and bronze is just a catch term. Bronze doesn't really mean very much. It's a copper alloy. If it's pure copper, we call it brass. But you can also add base elements to the mix, like lead. The heavier it becomes, the more lead and the less copper. That's why real connoisseurs of this material will tell the authenticity of a work, not by looking at it, but by picking it up and holding it. The heavier it is, the less likely it is to be an object of great value. Now, if you look at the economic situation, and I'm afraid I'm doing something which most real economists would quite be put off by. I'm using today's prices, 2013 prices, and I'm also doing it in American dollars. This is what appears when you go to websites and you look for the precious metals market. And I did this research about a few days ago. I think I did it over the weekend. Gold prices were $1,681 an ounce, and I think they must still be around. There hasn't been an enormous fluctuation in the last 7 days, while copper prices are less than $3.50 a pound. In other words, if you took that sculpture and you made it out of solid gold, you'd really be in the money. If you made it out of copper, let's say it weighs 25 pounds, you multiply 25 by 3, you'd have about $75 invested in materials, and then perhaps with only an ounce of gold, you could cover the object in gilt and make it look as glittery as you want it to look. Now, this brings us to what I think is one of the signature traits of the Italian Renaissance, and that is the change in valuation of the kind of object that would not only be on a dining table, but would also be hanging on the wall. And the great apostle of this notion of value in Renaissance is Leon Battista Alberti, the great theoretician who wrote on all matters of subjects. But his book on painting, from which this expert is taken, is the one that's most widely read, even by artists today. And Alberti writes, there are many people who use gold. They think it gives majesty. There is more admiration and praise for the artist who imitates the rays of gold with colors. And he's referring, of course, to painters who were painting instead of using gold ground, which is the tradition of painting that he inherited when he came into the profession. So it's the matter of imitation of something and the skill with which the craft was applied is more important than the intrinsic value of the object itself. Not that intrinsic value disappears by any means, but there becomes somewhat more of an equal equation between skill and craftsmanship. And we know this is, of course, the period where artists become known by name. This is the artist's this is the period when artists' biographies are written. This is the period when artists' autobiographies are written. And so the prizing of skill is something that is sort of driving the market in painting to a certain extent. Now, if you back to this silly chart again, you've got the gold prices at $1,681 an ounce. You've got silver, which is considerably lower than that. That price, actually, I just considered today, silver was selling in world markets for $29 today. Then we've got copper prices at $3.34 a pound. And then refined sugar, which brings me to the real point of this evening's talk. Refined sugar can be had for 8 cents or a little less than 9 cents a pound. And as gold prices were rising in this period, and here I must say I'm just relying on secondary sources, gold prices, and it seems a little paradoxical, doesn't it? But more and more gold is being imported into Europe, meaning Spanish traders from the New World. But it creates an inflationary situation, which I'm not sure I really understand. The 17th century is known as the period of the inflationary revolution. Now, at the same time, that luxury items made of gold, this would include jewelry and every manner of thing, would be made of precious metal. While the price of that is rising in the European economy, the price of sugar is declining because much more of it is being produced at a much lower cost. And how is it being produced? It's one of the great stains on Western civilization that is being produced through slave labor in places like Brazil and the West Indies. And we have the Portuguese to thank for putting that little thing together. So sugar is getting less expensive. Gold is becoming more expensive. What would you do if you were setting out a banquet table in the year 1600? Now, the kind of sugar I'm talking about is, of course, refined sugar. And refined sugar was known in antiquity. It was known in the eastern part of the world. And it came into use actually really quite early in time. The earliest mention I have of something being made of sugar, not just eating sugar. Well, people do talk about the sweet tooth of 17th century Europe, the taste for all those sweet little cakes, which I know people in Malta love so much. That seems to be a taste that began at some point in the 17th century. But if you look at the refined sugar in the upper left and compare it with powdered marble, you see the point that there's a luminescence about sugar that is really quite a valuable substance once you learn how to use it. Now, I know this comparison might strike a lot of people as a bit fatuous, but I compare here, of course, George W. Bush with Queen Elizabeth. George W. Bush is the beneficiary of all those wealthy Republicans in the state of Texas. His likeness is made of marble, which, again, using virtually today's prices, comes in at about $200 a ton. But, as you know, a marble sculpture can weigh several tons. Queen Elizabeth, on the other hand, it doesn't look like she's having a very good time while she's having this portrait made. Queen Elizabeth is 9 cents a pound, and sugar's not really very expensive. I mean, you could pick that sculpture up very easily and walk somewhere with it. So you see that, and of course, sugar sculpture also could be painted and it could be gilded. And what the artisan of this object has done, the Elizabeth sculpture, is to paint it. It's kind of that hideous polychromy that we're all sort of embarrassed about acknowledging existed so much in ancient art, Greco-Roman sculpture, which we think is pure white marble, was itself polychromed, often be quite gaudy in colors, not just statuary, but also buildings. And the fact that sugar and its various derivatives can be fashioned so inexpensively leads to this whole industry of wedding cake design. And here you've got this absolutely hideous construction, which is probably for a family that really couldn't afford much else. I find it interesting that it's the only attribute of this monument. They've included a Lambretta motor scooter, as if this young couple had to go off from their wedding on a motor scooter, couldn't even afford a car or a limousine. Now, the first instance we have of primary sources that talk about this kind of thing originates in the Middle East, as do so many novel ideas in the arts and in science that we in the West will now pretty much take credit for, but it's surprising how many things do originate in that part of the world. Of course, not so far from here either. I have to remember, in the 11th century, we have a description that survives of a caliph celebrating the Islamic holy days with artworks from the sugar bakers, which included 157 figures and 7 table-sized palaces or buildings. This is the 11th century. This is before this happens anywhere in Europe. And we have also the beginnings in the 15th century, if not illustrations all the time, we have descriptions of such things occurring, usually in wedding feasts, just as grandiose wedding cakes are mainly confined to wedding banquets today. So they were, I think, in the Renaissance. And this famous wedding that occurred in Rimini in 1475, you see all the produce that was consumed, you know, 680 chickens. That's a lot of food. But in the court chronicle also mentions that there were sugar sculptures made in the shape of the famous monuments of Rimini. And they actually mention what those monuments were. And one of the most, perhaps the most famous monument in Rimini is the triumphal arch of the Emperor Augustus. And that was there in sugar sculpture. But there was something else there. And that was a sugar sculpture of the as if completed building of what we know as the Tempio Malatestiano, or the church of San Francesco in Rimini, begun by Leon Battista Alberti, but not completed. And the only evidence that still survives as to what this building would have looked like had it been completed is that medal, which is the first foundation medal ever minted, which gives a very crude version of what it looked like. There was a sugar sculpture, and it was fashioned in the way it was to have been completed. So for a short period of time, the actual working model for this church existed. And after everyone looked at it and admired it, they ate it. The earliest illustration we have of such things, which seemed to be fairly commonplace, is another wedding which occurred in 1475, and that is the wedding of Costanzo Sforza and Camilla d'Aragona in Pesaro in the same year. And here, we have somebody visiting from the Vatican. This is a very beautiful illustrated manuscript in the Vatican Library, and I'll show you a couple of the folios from it. And it gives an idea what these things might have looked like. They're on carts with wheels, and I think you have some ships on wheels in the collection here. And these certainly appear to have been polychromed. They might have been gilded. They're all allegorical figures, which would allude to the virtues of the figures who were being married that day. And this just happily survives. Most such things don't really survive. But I mentioned deception. And this was an era where deception was raised to a very high level in literature, where one of the fondest themes in literature, which we think was rather comedic, are people disguising their appearances and to appear as someone else, right? Someone appears at a woman's bedroom, disguised as her husband. Isn't that funny? And here we have a recipe which I found in one of the notable cookbooks of this period. In fact, it's the first cookbook with an attributed name. There were cookbooks that preceded this in the Middle Ages, but this is the first cookbook for whom we actually know the author, Bartolomeo Sacchi, in 1470. And he tells us, and this is just a short passage from a much longer description of how to cook a peacock. You cook it, you cover it with its own skin, which you've carefully saved and reserved on one side, so that it seems to stand on its feet. In other words, you reattach the beak, you reattach the feet to it. You put little iron rods through it so it stands up straight, doesn't flop over in the plate, and none of that is seen, and so the diner thinks they're looking at a live peacock on their plate, when in fact it's a cooked peacock, and it's all ready to eat. Now, Giorgio Vasari, in his Lives of the Artists, singles out one rather minor Florentine artist in which he has a lengthy digression about companies of painters in Florence in the 16th century. The first edition of Vasari is 1550. The main amplified edition is 1568. He's talking about a phenomenon that occurred at some point back in the 1520s or 30s. He singles out in this case, there are many instances he does this, I'm just showing one, Andrea del Sarto, who's a well-known artist, we know he died in 1531. Sarto was with a group of artists called the Company of the Cauldron, and one of their activities was to get together and to prepare meals that look like other things. In this case, it's the big panettone, the ultimate panettone, which is the baptistry of Florence Cathedral, and here's a lengthy description about it's made of jelly and colored, let's see, the columns look like porphyry, but they're actually large sausages. And the bases and capitals were Parmesan cheese, the cornices were made of pastry and sugar, tribune of marzipan, and so forth. So it was all kind of a sight gag, which you could look at and enjoy and maybe talk about for a while, and then you could eat it. And then it was gone. And so works like this exist really only in the literature. This is often the case of ancient works of art as well, where you've got a literary ekphrasis, but you have no monument any longer to look at. You have to try to reconstruct it. And then there's really no shortage of these. It's just kind of a sampling of some descriptions that survive, usually in cookbooks, recipe books, and menus of the period. This is not the same man. We just looked at a recipe by Bartolomeo Sacchi. This is Bartolomeo Scappi. And his book was published exactly 100 years later in 1570. And, oh, I'm sorry, this is the Sanuta diary. This is the Venetian ambassador who's in Rome, and he attends a dinner that's put on by a cardinal, and it's attended by three other cardinals and several prostitutes, according to this. And it talks about this held in a chamber where these triumphi da tavola, which are triumphs of the table, is what we're talking about, these large objects that would be on the table. These were made of skulls filled with roast pheasant and bones made of sausages. Some people were obviously appalled by this idea, but they all had to admit it was one of the most beautiful dinners ever given in Rome. Yeah, and here's the Scappi, not Sacchi, but Scappi, his cookbook where he has in, and there are many of these, I just sort of pulled a few of them out, where you can, there's a whole recipe for preparing a fish to look like the head of a goat, preparing fish to shape them like chickens, and to take salmon and gelatin and make it look like ham. This is the level of wit that exists in this period. Now, one of the spectacular ones I'm really very keen on myself is from the 17th century, the Neapolitan populace put together a festival for one of their favorite viceroys. They weren't didn't have too many favorite viceroys, but Antonio Alvarez, who was the Duke of Alba, was celebrated with 12 triumphal arches, which were made out of edibles and drinkables. There were fountains with shooting wine and Prosecco and so on. And there was this object, which fortunately it's the only object to be preserved in an engraving. And it looks like a fairly routine arched doorway of the kind I'm really kind of amused to see exist so commonly here in Malta. You people who live in Valletta probably think nothing of this, to see a rusticated, banded doorway. Now, the banded rustication is certainly not the inventor of this foodstuffs, and it didn't originate in Malta either, but it comes from a plate in a very widely dispersed, widely read treatise of the 16th century by Sebastiano Cirlio, who was himself a member of the court in Fontainebleau and was really working side by side with Cellino Cellini in the service of Francis I. And he did this volume, which has come out in many editions and languages. And obviously in Naples, somebody got their hands on this edition and decided for the columns and the capitals and so forth to substitute little pigs for capitals, great sausages and hams and so forth. And according to the documentary evidence for this, after everyone went through the procession and feted the viceroy, they all feasted on the arches. They had 12 arches to feast upon, to eat and drink from. Now, to change to the figural side of things, there's a very odd phenomenon that occurs with sugar sculpture, and that is that the molds that could be used and were used, had been used, to make bronze sculpture, cast bronze, could also be used, the same molds could be used and filled with sugar paste to make sugar sculpture. Now, this seems to sort of float around the circle of the great sculptor John Bologna, who we know, probably everyone knows the great marble sculptures he has in Loggia dei Lanzi in Florence, the Rape of the Sabines, and so forth. But John Bologna's shop was also very active in making bronze replicas of larger sculptures and some bronze originals. These are two bronze that were made in the shop by the hand of John Bologna himself. Now, John Bologna, in the last years of his life, wasn't able to work very much. Something prevented him. And he had an assistant by the name of Pietro Tacca, T-A-C-C-A. And Tacca had the idea he could just crank these things. And he used the molds for bronze sculptures from the John Bologna studio, and he repeatedly made these sculptures made out of sugar. And after John Bologna died, Tacca lived on until 1640, he continued to make these. So they finally, well, the original ones that John Bologna was responsible for were at Medici weddings and banquets. But in the Tacca era, they had a much more widespread distribution and actually found their way into the middle class, who also would first admire them and then eat them. Now, one of the most extraordinary figures who plays a role in this is Queen Christina of Sweden. Queen Christina of Sweden was the daughter, the only daughter, of that notable Protestant Gustavus Adolphus. And in 1655, she had inherited the throne upon her father's death. She was the Queen of Sweden. She decided to convert to Roman Catholicism. This is the biggest triumph that the papacy had seen in a long, long, long time, really. And she made her way, disguised as a man, to Rome, where she was greeted with a very formal entrance into the northern gate of the city of Rome, the Piazza del Popolo, which was redesigned, permanently redesigned, and still looks this way today, by Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And the annual medal of Pope Alexander VII, who many of you know because he was the inquisitor here in Malta in the 1620s before he was elected to the papacy in 1655, he celebrated this like no other celebration. This was Roma Triumphans. This was really getting back, this was payback time for the Protestants. We converted one of their own. This would have been like during the Cold War, having some head of state defect. And so there's incredible celebrations that went on in honor of Christina. And fortunately, there was a Frenchman who was hanging around those days and who had access to the Vatican, and his name was Pierre Sévin. And he drew these rather crude drawings, I must say, of various banquets, which were held in Christina's honor. This is one, you get the idea of the scope of the room, and you also, I think, pretty clearly see that protocol demanded that Christina not sit on the same level as Alexander. She had to be at her own table at a lower level, sitting in a less comfortable chair, and they, of course, were not also allowed to speak directly to one another. One of the Sevan drawings shows a little courtier going in between, saying something like, you know, Her Highness says to His Excellency, he looks very well tonight, or I don't know, some what in the world she would say to the Pope. But we have here a detail of what was on that table. There were several of these feasts. I'm not precisely sure which day this one occurred, but it was drawn from life. And here you have the image that we've used on the poster here tonight is a drawing from the workshop of John Lorenzo Bernini. It's attributed to one of his assistants, a guy by the name of Shore, an Austrian artist who came to Rome. And this drawing would have been made specifically for that sculpture. And it's no accident that this drawing and that sugar sculpture represents a bird in flight. It's not any ordinary bird. It's a phoenix which rises from the ashes. And she saw this, Christina saw this as an allegory of her rising from the ashes of the Protestant faith to join the Catholic faith. And she had some medals made. She was a very vain woman. She had some medals made and so forth. And she had this medal made with her insignia, or her impresa, I suppose it really you should call it, that shows the same bird, of course. And this funny inscription, which only thanks to the speed of the internet, I was able to interpret that inscription about 2 hours ago. And there's lots of traffic flowing between here and the United States. And I discovered that that word that's written there, Malkia, in Greek, she put there and handed these medals to all the antiquarians of Rome to ask them what they thought of it and how they would translate the term. And several antiquarians in Rome put their heads together and came up with these sort of fabulous explanations of what that word means, when in fact, she made it up. It's not a Greek word. It's a Swedish word. It's a Swedish word written in the Greek alphabet. She was a very naughty girl. Queen Christina was involved in a murder for which defense she claimed was her own sovereignty. She had a very lurid love affair with a cardinal, Decio Azzolini, and was reprimanded by the Pope. She became a bit of an embarrassment for the Pope. And finally, it didn't end, so Azzolino was banished to Romania, and she continued to be an embarrassment, although there was this terrific propaganda coup that accompanied her. Now, one other thing that is related to this taste for sugar sculpture is the love of ephemera and the ephemeral in Baroque Rome. And even before we get to the 17th century, the love of fireworks, fuochi artificiali. And there are a number of prints that survive which show us what these things look like. This, of course, is the Ponte Sant'Angelo, and here's all the activity. And this would be gone in an instant. You would see it, and then you wouldn't see it. And I think this idea of savoring the temporary and the mutable and just enjoying it to its fullest at the moment and then having it disappear. Now, the last anecdote involved Christina. She's quite a fascinating woman to study. Christina was so impressed, not by the dinner table conversation with the Pope, but by the sugar sculptures, that she went home that evening to her palazzo, and I think she was in the Palazzo Corsini at the time, and she kept thinking about it, And she finally, the next day, sent a messenger over to the Vatican and said, Her Highness would like to return to the dining area to inspect the sugar sculptures. And the answer that came back from the Vatican was, Tell Your Highness, we're very sorry. They don't exist anymore. They were all eaten last night by the help. Now, there are more of these. I'm certainly not going to go through all of them by any means. And different events. Some of them are purely religious events, attending Lent. And in every one of these tables that was drawn during the reign of Alexander and into the next reign of Clement IX, some of these, like this Christ carrying the cross, you might be able to see. I'm not going to blow these up in details. These were works which came about and in one of three ways. One way was the original composition, such as we saw the Bernini school drawing on the left. Second was cast from a mold that originally had been made for bronze casting, and that's a sculpture in the middle by Alessandro Algardi, which is the only real rival that Bernini had. Exists in many, many casts. There are museums all over the world that have casts of the Algardi sculpture. Some of them are gilded, like this one, some are not. That's the second method. And the third method is actually, there's very little originality, I think, probably. Most of them are modeled on another existing works of art. And if you know Rome at all, and you cross the bridge, the Ponte Sant'Angelo, to the Castel Sant'Angelo, there are the angels lining up along the bridge, which were conceived by Bernini and executed by assistants. And one of, I'm not going to go back to it, but one of the table decorations we just looked at is made after the sculpture from there. So I want to change the nature of this talk a bit to bring up another principle of Baroque art, probably more than of Renaissance art, and this is the second part promised in this talk, which is, has to do with the notion of delight and instruction. And this has, of course, been around for a long time. If your form of communication is visual, and your audience at this time is predominantly non-literate, so they can't read these things, or dependent upon what some orator in the pulpit has to say about them, the first way to get someone's attention is to delight them, and that's the delectare. There was a famous debate which was held in Rome in the summer of 1635 at the Academy of St. Luke, the Artists' Academy, which debated this notion. What should it be, as if it could only be one or the other, and ended up being a kind of balance between delighting and instructing. And this is the next part of the talk that I want to talk about, is how tableware that was served at this time appealed to the mind in a way that did more than simply delighted or amused the viewer. Now, we're all aware that the ancient tradition in Greece is for tableware to be made of pottery and then to be painted. And initially, as on the left, in black figure on the terracotta ground, and then as it became more sophisticated and evolved, it reversed happens, it becomes red figure on the black glazed ground. Most of the Greek vases that are preserved have narrative scenes. They tell stories. There are scenes from Homer, there might be scenes from the Trojan War, which is fairly popular, or there might be Dionysiac scenes, especially on drinking cups. So while you're drinking, you have a scene that spurs on the merriment and the festivity of what you're doing. This was a tradition, the Greek tradition, which really died off and disappeared for all extents and purposes in the Roman period. Romans were fascinated more by what glitters than by what tells the story, and Roman silver is the primary expression of the culinary desire and gastronomic interest. The second expression of Roman culinary interest is their extensive use of glass, which can be very, very beautiful, but rarely, if ever, well, sometimes it does, has embossed relief sculpture on it. For the most part, I think it would be safe to say, I hope there are no classicists here, I think it would be safe to say that Roman sculpture drops the requirement for narration and takes up the requirement for beauty. And then, of course, there's the Middle Ages to contend with. And in the Middle Ages, we know that most of this material disappeared. Maybe the most noble households would use pewter or a base metal. But most of the time, from the evidence that survives, these will be called trenchers, which comes from the Italian word tagliare, or slice. These were slices of bread, and cookbooks actually recommend that the bread be about 5 days old, so it'd be stale bread, on top of which would then be heaped some gloppy substance like this and consumed. And what prints survive show this in action. Here's a guy cutting a loaf of bread. My arrow points to a trencher on the table. And then it's probably no surprise to realize that as we get at the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance, there's a reason why this period is called the Renaissance, after all. It's the rebirth of classical past, of classical learning, initially through texts, but also through images, and the notion that going back to ceramic ware as tableware and decorating it wasn't such a bad idea. And this is a piece, it's a rather humble piece, it's the size of a soup bowl. It's in the Detroit Institute of Arts. And it's decorated with a kind of Arabic decoration, abstract decoration. And this is what we call maiolica, which is not to be confused with majolica, even though that sounds could be spelled the same way. Majolica is that silly stuff that was made in the Victorian period, teapots in the shape of rabbits and squirrels. That's 19th century Victorian majolica. This is maiolica. It's soft paste medium and can be painted and fired. Initially started fairly abstractly, and I mean, this is a more complicated story than I have time to say, but it seems to have caught people's attention by the end of the 14th and beginning or through the 15th century. And here's a letter that Lorenzo de' Medici wrote in 1490, just 2 years before he died, to Roberto Malatesta, who's the guy who got married in Pesaro, we just commented on, where he says he received this gift of pottery. It's much to my taste. It gave me great pleasure. I appreciate and value these vessels more than if they had been made of silver. This is back to Alberti again, right? More than if they had been made of silver. Not the intrinsic value, it's the added value and the skill of the craftsman that delighted him. They're excellent and also rare and new to us here. Now, by the 16th century, there begins to reappear in the history of Western tableware the origins, the reimagining of the painted narrative tableware that we saw in ancient Greece. And these are works which are called historiated works, or historiato. Asking around where one finds these things on the island of Malta, I did come across one the other day by accident, quite a nice, large, historiated plate in the Cathedral Museum in Medina. I think all of you work in museums here should make that a priority for acquisitions, a nice historiated plate. Now, historiated maiolica, like this piece, which was made in Urbino, a great cultural capital at the time, presents a couple of challenges to the viewer and to the diner. The first challenge it presents is to wonder, what am I looking at? And partly that's just visual. What's going on here? Why is this guy who's naked, seated on a rock, very modestly posed? And why are these naked ladies standing all around him? And where does this come from, and what does it mean? And this becomes a test of erudition. And this is where the second part of this talk comes in. But don't worry, it won't be as long as the first part. It comes almost exclusively from reproductive prints that were made of works of art by notable artists like Raphael. And one of the beneficial side effects, shall we say, of the invention of the printing press was not just the ability to knock off texts at rapid speed, but it also led to the, almost explosion of the paper industry in Europe and the places where presses were working. So more papers being produced, and artists beginning in the later 15th century decided they could use this paper and the mechanics of the printing press to make prints, which were usually reproductive prints. And the best known of these people is, and when I, who did that? Maybe talk to your dinner partner. I know I've seen that. Who did it? Where's it from? Well, maybe this will be a test of your art historical knowledge. You would say, yes, it's Marc Antonio Raimondi after a painting, now unfortunately lost painting, by Raphael. Okay, that answers the first question, the visual demands of the object. The second question is, what the heck does this mean? What's going on here? And here's where the Maiolica painters could be quite clever, and where their patrons, I think, sort of pushed them in the direction of being quite clever, because many, if not most of these plates, when you finish the meal and you turn it upside down, you see that on the foot of the plate, there is an inscription. This is the judgment of Paris. This is an easy one, right? Everybody probably recognizes the judgment of Paris to begin with, and it doesn't really give much more information than that. It doesn't say where it came from or so forth. Now, remember, when this plate is put in front of you and you are a diner, this plate is full of food. And just like Greek vases were for the most time full of red wine, and you do not see the decoration at the bottom. And I have to say, just a few weeks ago, I was just dying to try this. And I took a Greek vase, and I filled it with red wine, and all of the imagery disappeared. And it was a kylix, and only after it drained the wine from the kylix, and your nose is like right in front of it when you're drinking the wine, then you see the subject. And that's what would happen here. This is a nice soup of beans and Swiss chard, and you're slurping away on the soup, and then you get down to the subject. So it comes as a bit of a surprise. Now, some of these are really quite elaborate, and one of the finest services that was ever made was for the Pucci family in Florence, whose emblem is the Moor's Head. And these, of course, are all ceramic. They're easily breakable, and the survival rate is relatively low. But a colleague of mine, Giulia Triolo, has managed to track down in the museums and collections of the world 34 plates from the Pucci service. And the Pucci plates that survive fall into three categories: a large platter size, a main course entree size, and a smaller plate would be a bread plate or a salad plate. And the dimensions are really very similar to the dimensions that we're still eat on today. And this is part of the proliferation of goods that occurred in this period. More, I was looking at the table the other day in Plotzow Falzon. The table setting had, four forks, two knives, three or four spoons. It's a great specialization with dining. And I use the word dining now because this is the very period where eating became dining, when cooks became chefs, when food became cuisine and gastronomy came about. Cookbooks have recorded authors with very special recipes all of their own. Now we're going to look at just this one plate. This will be the last image I'll show you as we're all starting to get hungry looking at that zupa. We look at this plate, and I wonder if anyone here recognizes the subject. The real iconographers here. Well, you don't have to say anything because you're in a large group of people, and there's really no embarrassment about saying nothing. But suppose you were at dinner, and you're seated at a formal dinner, and this plate is put in front of you or it's put next to your table mate, and you say, "What's going on here?" Again, some women on the left side, one clothed, a couple nude, some birds flying over their head. And over on the other side, an old guy with a beard and a barrel. First challenge, because like, where is this coming from? Once again, it's the figure on the right comes from Marco Antonio Raimondi after Raphael. The figure on the left is another printmaker of the period who's looking at works by Rosso Fiorentino. And that's where those figures come from. Okay, what does the plate mean? What in the world is going on here? And you can sit and discuss it and disagree and talk about your knowledge of classic texts. And the texts generally, by the way, they're mainly going to be Ovid in this period because Ovid was illustrated with prints. And it was possible to get an illustrated Ovid edition, and certain other authors like Virgil were not illustrated, Petrarch were not illustrated. There were a few others that they would use. There are also some religious subjects, needless to say. But in this case, after you finish the contents of your meal, you turn the plate over, and then there's quite a lengthy inscription that gives you all the information I think a modern museum curator would want to have on the catalog. The date, first of all, 1532, and then the subject. The daughters of King Aeneas in Pucullumbe turned into doves in the 13th L Libro book of Ovid Metamorphosis. So if you really want to check on the subject, which I'm not going to talk about anymore, go to the 13th book of Ovid, and there it will be. It will be Dionysus turning the daughters of Aeneas into doves. And then you say, well, this is really quite a nice plate. Who did this? I want to know who did this. Well, he puts his name down there, Francesco Zanto, A for Avelli. His real name is Francesco Avelli. Francesco Zanto Avelli da Rovigo, made in Urbino. Now, isn't that nice? What this is really all about and what concludes this talk is the fact that the art of dinner table conversation was a more elevated practice than it is today when people have the television going in the background or they're sitting making small talk or gossip. But there was a ritual of conversation in the later Renaissance, and there are a number of books. This book is a dialogue of games by a guy named Baraglio. These are games played in the evening companies of Siena. And in this text, he contrasts two kinds of games, games of jest and games of knowledge. And the game of knowledge would be the test of have you read and do you remember your Ovid? And if you do, which book of Ovid's Metamorphosis did this story come from? The other book is this book of the civil conversation, the polite conversation, first edition 1574, seven editions in the next century in three different European languages. This book was read. It was published and republished. And the author here, Stefano Guazzo, says, all the delights of this supper shall not depend on the sweet taste of meats, but on the pleasant discourse of those present. So Thank you. Buon appetito and